And our next guest has interviewed Patti Smith, amongst many others, in fact, around 1,000 pop culture icons. And her new book, A Seat at the Table, is interviews with women on the front line of music, which is basically trying to be an antidote to the boys' club that so much of the music business has always been through the years. Delighted to welcome Amy Raphael to the show. Morning, Amy.
Morning, Bill.
Good to talk
to you.
Great. I mean, you're just playing the Patti Smith record there. You didn't really interview her for 24 hours, did you?
I really did. That record brought back very specific memories, actually, because I went to Paris to interview Patti for The Observer, and we were supposed to do just, you know, the typical one-hour-long interview,
yeah.
And I turned up at the hotel, and she had a very bad migraine. And I have had a few migraines in my time, so I just said, look, I can go away and come back later. And she said, no, sit with me. And so I sat with her in silence,
wow.
As though we were kind of praying or something. And then David Lynch turned up.
Of course,
the American director
yes.
turned up, and we had a chat with him. And then she wanted to do the interview in a hotel room because she wanted to be in a darkened room, and we did that. And then she was doing this thing that they do annually in Paris called the Nuit Blanche, the White Night, where old buildings that are never normally open to the public are opened, and bands do gigs through the night. And she did this incredible gig in a church, but she invited me to the sound check in the afternoon, and she played Because the Night.
Oh.
And I was just sitting in the pews on my own watching her rehearse Because the Night, and it was one of the most incredible moments of my life.
Oh, how wonderful. And I'm guessing she was a nice lady as well.
Oh, she was great. Super,
yeah.
Super bright, super engaged, political, just fantastic.
I mean, I mentioned there, you've done a lot of interviews, and likewise, I in my radio career over many, many years have done a lot of interviews, and people always say to me, and it's a really difficult question, who is your favourite, and who was difficult? I've got a couple. But were there any horrors that you're prepared to talk about?
Yes, I don't mind, because it was such a long time ago. I mean, I mostly over the course of my career have interviewed men because
yeah.
I've written about music and film and football, mostly music and film. But I went to New Orleans in the mid-90s, I think it was, to interview Lenny Kravitz.
Yeah.
And it's a hell of a long journey to New Orleans. And I think we were there for two nights, and even though I was much younger than I am now, I was still, you know, I felt quite battered when I got there, and we did the interview in his house, and in this room in his house, which had a shag pile carpet,
right.
And all his gold discs on the wall, which I was a bit like, you know, and he was just, I just found him incredibly arrogant,
yeah.
And I told, I don't like to criticize people in print, because I just told the story as it was, as I found it, and
yeah.
He complained. To the
no,
company, because
oh, no.
He wasn't used to people not kind of deifying him, I think. So, I mean, he wasn't unpleasant, so to speak. You know, he wasn't outright unpleasant. He was just, I found him incredibly arrogant. And,
wow.
And I found that.
Isn't it? And it's a shame, isn't it? Because people that you have respect for that you interview, who kind of let you down when you actually meet them, that's a terrible thing. I mean, it's happened to me a few times. And the one for me, and I'm sure he's a very nice man, but was Paul Weller, who was just, again, very arrogant and very kind of non-forthcoming in what was a record review show, you know, and he had to review other people's records. And he was so disparaging about everybody.
Oh, my God.
I found it really hard.
Yeah.
It's a shame, isn't it? Because it kind of tarnishes your view of their music after that, in a way. It's weird.
I know. Well, I think, I mean, it's that the old adage, isn't it? Don't meet your heroes. But
yeah.
And I think knowing that he's grumpy, for example, I could never meet Bob Dylan.
Yes. Well, he was here in southern Spain doing a concert about 3 weeks ago, and apparently he didn't say a word from the beginning to the end of the concert. Not a word.
Oh, but you've got to love him for that. You've got to love him for that, because he's Bob Dylan. He can do what he wants.
Yeah.
I mean, he has a license to be grumpy, I think.
Yeah.
But,
interesting life you've had. I mean, another guy I've got great respect for, you've been working on his autobiography, Steve Coogan.
Yes.
Oh,
yes.
He's a genius.
Yes, I did. That came out a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
I've known him since the early 90s, actually,
wow.
Because when I used to work at the Face magazine, he was one of the first people. Well, in fact, I went to see Frank Skinner in Edinburgh, and Steve Coogan was supporting him, and he was absolutely terrible. and I mean, by his own admission, he was absolutely terrible. But I remember just thinking, God, who's this awful comedian supporting Frank Skinner? And then I went to Edinburgh the next year, and Steve wasn't there. And then he came back the following year with Partridge.
Brilliant.
And won the Perrier.
Yeah.
And he was so distraught by how awful he was when he was supporting Frank Skinner that he came back and kind of blasted it out of the water. So.
I've got to say, as someone who spent all my career in radio since the 70s, you know, to see his character, Alan Partridge, as a broadcaster, just strikes so many chords with me as to people I've worked with. It's just horrendous to watch
I mean, you say people you've worked with, but were you watching it? Have you ever watched it and thought, oh my God, I've done that? You must have.
Occasionally. There's an occasional few things I've kind of gone, oh no, I'm sure I've done that at some point in the past. But it's just brilliantly observed, isn't it? And great to see that he was back on the BBC recently.
Yeah, really good. And the first time on the BBC in 17 years or something, I think.
Absolutely, so. Yeah. Now, to the book, A Seat at the Table. Not the first book you've written about women in the music industry, but this one has a kind of interesting twist because it's a lot of kind of modern artists you've talked to here. What's the kind of philosophy behind this, then?
Well, I the first book I wrote, Never Mind the Bollocks, Women Rewrite Rock, came out in the mid-90s and was published by Virago in the UK and St. Martin's in America. And maybe 10 years after it was published, Virago asked me if I would update it. And I didn't really think that there was a need to. I felt like we'd made some progress in the music industry and that women were being treated with more respect. And then I read a couple of articles that changed my mind.
Right.
One was an interview that Björk did, and she was in my first book. And she was, when I interviewed her for the first book, she wasn't anti-feminist, but she was very insistent that being a woman in the music industry wasn't a problem at all and had never been an issue for her. And then she did a fantastic interview in Pitchfork, the online music magazine, in which she said that actually she was really fed up with the way that every time she'd co-produced one of her records, the male producer that she'd worked with had got all the glory, and nobody had ever thought. Everybody just assumed that because she was the woman, she wasn't capable of producing her own work.
Yeah.
And she just said, you know, I've had enough now, and I'm going to talk about it all the time. And she was saying, look, you know, if women are going to be photographed, they should be photographed in the studio.
Yeah.
You know, in situ, showing that they work. And so that was one thing that I just thought, well, that's quite interesting that somebody who's in the first book's actually changed her mind.
Yeah.
And then there was a piece that Lauren Mabry from the British band Churches wrote for The Guardian, in which she talked about being trolled online because she was daring to appear in a video in a mini dress and with slicked back hair.
Right.
And apparently that was a disgraceful way of behaving, and she got rape threats and death threats.
Good
and, and I just thought, hang on a minute, the internet has actually, what is the effect of the internet? You know, the internet didn't really exist when I wrote the first book, and for example, I've given women in both books copy approval, so Courtney Love, who was in the first book, would FedEx back her notes, with annotated with red lipstick.
Great.
In typical Courtney Love.
Brilliant.
Style. Or Kim Gordon from the band Sonic Youth would fax back her notes.
I didn't know anyone still had a fax machine.
Yeah, we know the fax machine would wake me up. I remember it was at the end of my bed, and it would wake me up at 3 a.m. when the Americans would start sending faxes. So I just thought, okay, the internet is actually has made things easier for women in that they can use websites like Bandcamp to post their own music.
Yes.
But also it's allowed all these faceless people to be very aggressive.
Keyboard warriors.
And Billy No Mates, probably.
Yeah,
basically.
Exactly.
But I started thinking about it a bit more, and then I thought, well, it would be interesting to update it and not talk to the same women, but talk to a different bunch of women. And of course, at the beginning, Virago were very keen that I tried to get the likes of Beyonce and her sister Solange and all those huge American acts. I mean, you get nowhere.
No,
you get absolutely nowhere with those acts. And, you know, they absolutely control their everything they do.
Yeah.
And I think even, and if they wanted to do a book, they'd do their own books. And I understand that. So I just thought, after a fruitless few months, I just thought, okay, why don't I just talk to the women whose music I love and who have really good stories and will actually be honest. And so I started, the first one I did was Christine and the Queens.
Yep.
Who at that point, that was 2017, was just beginning to make a name for herself. And, you know, there's other things that had happened in that gap between the first book and the second book, which was gender being redefined, sexuality being redefined, and there were some gay women in the first book, but they didn't talk about their sexuality in the way that Chris talks about her sexuality.
Mm.
You know, and that I didn't even know what the word, I don't even know if the word pansexual existed.
Right.
In the mid-90s. But so quite a lot had changed in that time. And there was some very grim stories and some very enlightening positive stories, but in fact the best experience I've had is in Spain, funnily enough.
Okay.
Last week when I came to Primavera with my 14-year-old daughter.
Yes.
and saw over the course of 3 days saw one male artist, the fantastic James Blake, but apart from that just a bunch of incredible women, from Princess Nokia to Janelle Monáe to Chris and the Queens to Dreamwife to Lizzo. And it just felt so joyous and empowering, and it was fantastic. But it didn't feel like tokenism. It didn't feel like, oh, we're just gonna make this a gender neutral festival and put a bunch of average women on. I mean,
yes.
Janelle Monáe was off the scale. She was superb.
Mm.
So I came away from Primavera, came back on Sunday, and just thought, no, if that's the future, then we're getting somewhere.
That's a really interesting point of view. I mean, the other side of my my career has been as a producer and writer, a songwriter over the years, and I've worked on many album projects. And over the years, I'm just thinking back now of all the big studios I've worked in around the world, and I would guess that out of, let's say, 100 projects, there would have been one female who was working as an engineer or as a co-producer or whatever in that environment. And that was the kind of old kind of boys club almost, wasn't it, in the music business it used to be the case. And in fact, it was very difficult to change that. And do you think the internet has actually been the catalyst for the change, because people now no longer need behemoth record labels to get on with making great records and getting them out into the world?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's two points, two things I'd say. One is that I've interviewed a producer in a seat at the table called Catherine Marks, who won a couple of years ago, won Producer of the Year.
Yes.
And not Female Producer of the Year, just Producer
Absolutely.
Of the Year. And she's not particularly a feminist. She's pretty straight-talking Australian. But there was no doubt in her mind that she had to just work as hard as all the guys had worked.
Yeah.
But she was saying, for her, it's about role models. And the more women, the more female producers there are, or engineers, the more there will be.
Yeah.
Because it's about visibility and profile and so on.
Yeah.
The second part of the question, has the internet... Yeah, I think that there's another woman in my book, Poppy Ajuda, who's got a fantastic Amy Winehouse type kind of jazzy pop voice, and she's decided not to sign to a major, even though she had lots of interest in them, because she didn't want to be. She's a mixed heritage, dual heritage woman from London. She's gay. She's very, very outspoken, and she felt like all the major label guys she went to see were privileged white men, in her words, privileged white men telling her what to do.
Yeah.
And she just thinks, you know, she was hoping that we'd have got past that point, but clearly we haven't with some of the major labels.
Mm.
So she puts her own music out, and she's doing really well.
Exactly.
And with the power of Instagram and Twitter, she can you know, she can talk, she can let the world know when she's playing gigs, when she's got music out, and so on. I mean, obviously, she's, you know, her progress is not going to be as fast as somebody who's backed by a Warner Brothers or Sony or whatever, but I still think, yeah, I mean, I don't think MySpace all those years ago would have given you that power.
No, that's right. I mean, I you've got me thinking now, and I've just thought back to this horrific experience I had in a major recording studio once with I can't name him, but he was a world famous record producer who was co-producing a record with me, and the artist was a female artist, and her manager was also female, and I remember having a conversation in the middle of the studio one day where he actually said to me in front of the female artist, ask her what she thinks about this part that we're just doing. And she said, I'm standing in front of you. And he was such a misogynist that he couldn't actually direct the question straight at her because she was a woman. And so, her view didn't really matter, despite the fact she was, of course, the artist. But actually, the next day, she walked off the project, needless to say, and didn't come back. So, yeah. Well, it's a fascinating book, and it's a book of now, isn't it? There's a lot of talk, obviously, about the Me Too campaign and queer politics and misogyny, and that's a great thing that it's being brought to the forefront and it's inflicting some change on the music business because it's been a long time coming.
It has been a long time coming.
It's a great book. It's been lovely to talk to you. It's called A Seat at the Table, Interviews with Women on the Frontline of Music. Amy Raphael, thank you so much for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much. Have a good day.
And you. Bye-bye.